Welcome to this week's edition of the Aquila Report in Weekly Review. This is Dominic Aquila along with Paul Harrell, and it's Monday, May 13, as we get ready to speak about the 10 top articles from last week on the Aquila Report that the Aquila Report readers have read. And then we count them up and get our top 10 list of articles read. This gives us an opportunity to tease things out and to explain a little bit background, or just to say things that come to mind with these various articles. And so Paul and I meet weekly for this. So tomorrow, on the 14th of May, you will receive in your inbox the top 10 list, all hyperlinked and ready for you to click on. And we, as we always suggest, if you find them interested, just forward the email to family and friends, your small group leaders, and other people that you think might be interested in receiving this and being, read articles that are here. So anyway, Paul, we're ready to go. And just,
yes, sir.
You had a good week here. And I know that you had some rough weather up your way, at least to parts of your area.
We did. I mean, my area was spared, but I know down in Hot Springs, they had a tornado hit the ground. And then I know, Tennessee, they were pretty ravaged by, several.
Yeah, we even had one in the panhandle of Florida around the Tallahassee area.
Mm-hmm. I have family in Tallahassee now.
Yes, so it's really amazing. Okay, well, we're here to do the Aquila Report and Weekly Review. So why don't you read the top 10 from 10 to 6? I'll do 5 to 1, and we'll begin.
Absolutely. So number 10, actually by Brad Isbell, a guy I was texting the other night when the storms were rolling through Oak Ridge, Tennessee, making sure he was okay. And he's got a great article about an overture. He says an overture to assist the accused. That's number 10 from last week. Really, really good. Number 9, we've got Aaron M. Wren back on the list. This title, Will the End of Protestantism Be the End of America? Coming in at number 8 last week, Providence Christian College Board calls Dr. Stephen B. Kortenhoven as president. This written by staff. And then number, 10, 9, 8, 7. Number 7, we've got Paul Barth, Pado Baptism. Yes, Pado Communion. No. And coming in at number 6, Jane Voss, A Review, A Christian Guide to Mental Illness by David Murray and Tom Carroll Jr.
Okay, then number 5, Stonewall Jackson, Saved by Providence by David T. Crum. We have number 4, Well, That Didn't Take Long by Al Mohler. Then number 3, Culturally Respectable Racism by Carl Truman. And then number 2 is also by Carl Truman. Two different publications that his articles were in. And this number 2, What the Pro-Palestinian Campus Protests Are Really About. And then number 1 is entitled The PCA Invites, Presbyterian Church in America Invites Professional Polarizer David French to Lecture Christians on Getting Along. And so that's number 1. This article from Kylie Griswold arises from an article in The Federalist, in which there was a response to David French having received an invitation and apparently accepted it to be one speaker on a panel at the June General Assembly of the Presbyterian Church in America, the PCA, which will be meeting in Richmond, Virginia, June 10 through 16. So in the subheading, she says, if the PCA wants to have David French talk about polarization, it should be as a poster child, not a panelist. So from the title, as well as that subtext title, Kylie believes that they're probably more of a polarizer than a gatherer. So 1 month from today, so that is on the June 10th, it will be, Presbyterian leaders will gather in Richmond, Virginia, for the Presbyterian Church in America's annual General Assembly to discuss, debate church issues, and decide on matters of importance. One attendee, speaker, however, is decidedly not Presbyterian. The little ray of sunshine is David French, the Army JAG, in case you didn't know, turned religious liberty litigator turned writer whose brain has been so corrupted by Trump derangement that he sold out to the New York Times and the Atlantic, where his columns are indistinguishable from the dishonest drivel of the legacy press's anti-religious religion reporters. In a phrase, he's a regular accuser of the brethren. So that's quite a mouthful coming from Kylie Griswold about this. And so he, French, was invited to be a panelist on a seminar that would be assembly-wide. In other words, there are a number of seminars that are held that are small groups and throughout the week of General Assembly with many presenters on them. And then there's one that's usually held that's assembly-wide for everybody. And it was going to be a panel of about four or five individuals. And he was invited to be one of those leaders. So in this article, she just, muses on the fact that David French has not been very friendly. He had been a member, apparently, of a local Presbyterian church in America, a PCA congregation. And so he since left it because he didn't want to be associated with neo-Confederates, as he wrote. And then there are quite a few other things that she hyperlinks in this article, of things that have been said that have not been sort of friendly to those who would be more in the conservative side of the political spectrum, and maybe even also of the confessional side of the ecclesiastical spectrum. So it stirred up quite a bit, Paul, in the church when the announcement came from the official denomination news online magazine to announce that he was coming. So I just to say that there has been quite a bit of pushback, not joy in Mudville, quite a few things. So it's number one. I can see why it was number one. I think when time it was posted, it verily did go viral. So it's instead of commenting too much on it, it'd probably be best to everyone just when you get your newsletter, you can read it and see what it really says. So, Paul, we start out with a real bang on this one.
I mean, we do. This was a firestorm, and it was also just a gut punch. You know, I know there was a lot of people thinking, oh, yeah, this General Assembly, it's the first General Assembly in a while, just going to be kind of controversy free. And we're just going to do the business of the church. And then something like this happens. And it's so ironic because it was supposed to be over the polarization of our time. Right. Like we are in this very hyper polarized environment, and somebody just didn't have the foresight to understand who exactly David French is. Or maybe they agree with him and they think David French is not a polarizing figure, which that would raise way more questions than I think you would get answers. So, yeah, no, it's no wonder that this is the number one article. I don't know. There's people that want David French to be uninvited, which will obviously then create another controversy. But I just think that to me, that would seem that the logical conclusion to make. Haven't heard anything, and I don't think we'll hear anything for a while. But I mean, just personally, Dominic, as somebody that follows the news and you know, I'm somebody that's clearly on the right of things on the political spectrum. I put David French in that category that I put, you know, Rick Warren back in 2008 when he went to the World Economic Forum and encouraged the World Economic Forum to use local pastors and people, you know, Christians in the public sphere to essentially, and now he didn't say this, but this is my words, sanitize, you know, regime rhetoric to kind of pacify Christians so they don't actually do anything. You know, it's the whole when gay marriage was legalized by the Supreme Court, you know, we got lectures from some who said we need to be careful that we're not idolizing the family. Things like that. I put David French in that category, and I think many other people do as well. In this particular piece, and I'll just briefly read this and move on, she writes, long before French became a willing participant in atheist Rob Reiner's anti-Trump documentary God and Country, which, by the way, came out earlier this year and it was a big bomb, he was invoking white guilt to toss a cohort of Christians who vote differently than he does into the Christian nationalism basket. He said evangelicals, specifically white ones, who were hesitant about getting the rushed and mandated COVID jab were actually reluctant to consider the health of their community. Of course, we know AstraZeneca has now pulled it off of the market. He also insinuated that we have a spiritual problem, right? This was all this was also kind of the love your neighbor, wear a mask types. And then she goes on, she writes, less than 2 weeks after radical pro-abortion and pro-transgender candidate Joe Biden became the presumptive Democrat nominee in 2020, French said those who favored Trump were of low character and competence, even though, as Nathaniel Blake wrote in these pages, French was previously behind evangelicals for Mitt, meaning Mitt Romney back in 2012, and spent years arguing that our political leaders need not be avatars for our beliefs, because obviously at the time, Dominic, Christians were worried about voting for a Mormon, right? So, but that didn't matter because they don't need to be political leaders don't need to be avatars for our beliefs in 2012, but now they basically are in 2016 and 2020. Anyway, that's all my thoughts on that.
Well, the you could see just by the way we're chatting about it and the things that have been said that this is definitely a polarizer, and that's the reason it was number one article by Kylie Griswold. Okay, then number two continues almost in this theme more about disturbance by Carl Truman. Like I said, the next one, two and three are from him and dealing with the same idea, but from a different perspective in each one. And what the pro-Palestinian campus protests are really about by Carl Truman. He says the recent pro-Palestinian student protest on elite university campuses across the country offer fascinating, if somewhat depressing, insights into the state of modern American church. It is not so much that the lunatics have taken over the asylum as the kindergartners have taken over the nursery. He says, first, society takes the attitudes and antics of the young far too seriously. In an era when we are reliably informed that adolescence persists well into the 20s, it is strange that we deem the views of anyone under the age of 30 to have any real significance or merit. And in another paragraph, he goes on to say, this exaltation of youth is simultaneously the exaltation of ignorance and incompetence. Early claims of Israeli occupation of Gaza and the continued sloppy use of the language of genocide, fueled by people at the UN who could benefit from using a dictionary, are two obvious examples of the former. As for the latter, for example, did adults of revolutionaries hold hunger strikes lasting a whole 12 hours or seize buildings and then demand that the university authorities give them food and water? I have no affection for Che Guevara, he says, but he did at least spend time in the Bolivian jungle while trying to foment revolution. So basically, he's saying that the type of work, the demonstrations that have been held are not really thought out by the students. And in this one paragraph of the beginning of it, he indicates that. This also points to the nihilism that lurks just below the surface. When one notes the craziness of some of the protests, that is, queers professing solidarity with Palestine, for example, or a drag queen leading children in pro-Palestinian chants, it becomes clear that for all of the blather about, quote, human rights, these people share no common vision about what it means to be human. The thing that unites these groups is neither concern for Arab lives nor a respect for Islamic culture. They are united only in wanting to tear down. In short, these protests are a manifestation of the Mesopothelian spirit of negation, or in religious terms, the spirit of desecration. So the point here is that in ordinary life, what Truman is saying, these two groups would never meet and believe in anything, since in the Islamic world, if you're caught to be a homosexual, they're most likely going to throw you off a roof of a tall building. And yet here they are celebrating together. So Americans have the right to protest Israeli military action, and American support of Israel, such as a right, is a key to a healthy and well-functioning democracy. As has been often said, it is what distinguishes countries like America from places like Iran. But when a 16-year-old who removes their hijab in protest in Iran at cultural restrictions are raped and murdered, not lionized by the media in that place. So who's leading the protest? People who are not aware, young folks of it. It's just something that they've been stirred up. And Carl Truman presents a really healthy analysis of the culture in which, without thinking much, they can be stirred up easily to disrupt the flow of traffic and classes and many other parts of culture. So this article by Carl Truman, I think, will be helpful. And I'll just go one more thing, Paul, before you make your comment, is that one of the other themes that I see in some of the other articles that we have coming is this, what we've been emphasizing here with a number of articles for the last few months, and I keep mentioning it because I see that coming up, is the Romanization, that is going back to Rome. What was the culture of the early church as it began to develop after Pentecost? It was deeply embedded in a Roman culture, which was very pagan, very secular, and which did not take time and abide much with the distinctives and distinguishing marks of the Christian church, because it was so antithetical to everything that was Roman. And yet over 300-400 years, the Christianization of culture began to happen, especially in the West. And now we see the thing flipping, because we've missed, the church has sort of given up some of its distinctives, is not living according to what the prescription of scripture is, and we're buying into the Romanization of culture once again. And this is one example, and we'll see a couple more coming up.
Absolutely. So I agree with Carl Truman's characterization of just basically the contradiction of the protesters, right? The apparent contradiction of them. I've been torn on this whole issue, though, because I have seen the images of what's going on over there in the Middle East. I've seen this pattern of telling the Palestinians that they need to evacuate to this other area of Gaza, and then that one gets bombed, you know, to the Stone Age, where women and children are absolutely slaughtered, right? And so I don't really have a problem with some of the language that's being used that he has a problem with. But then at the same time, as the protests were ratcheting up, I'm not naive. I know that the average protester on these college campuses would not be a fan of mine as a Christian, wouldn't be a fan of yours as a Christian, Dominic, you know, and probably a whole lot of other of my beliefs that I guess could be characterized as a biblical worldview, right? So I'm not naive to that. I think the bigger question here is, if you look at who's funding the protesters and what and kind of this infiltration that has gone on, there are reports that George Soros, who is pro-Israel, is fun, you know, his organizations are funding a lot of this stuff. There was an article on Fox News last week about the Pritzker family, the big hotel family, and they're pro-Israel and Jewish themselves, and they have ties to funding the pro-Palestinian protesters. And I mentioned, I think, a little bit of this last week. It feels very similar to 2020, just in terms of how things are becoming increasingly polarized. And it just seems like, to me, it's all kind of fake and by design. Certainly Truman's right about how malleable the protesters seem to be, and how manipulating or easily manipulated that they can be. But I just kind of see this whole thing as one giant national manipulation, much like what happened in 2020. So
yeah, well, that brings up then the second article by Truman, which is number 3 on the top 10 list, Culturally Respectable Racism, appeared in World Magazine, that Carl wrote this article for. He says, why aren't pundits who bashed evangelicals as racist more vocal about rampant anti-Semitism on the left? So hence the title, Culturally Respectable Racism. So it's okay to sound racist if you are on a certain side of the equation, but not necessarily on the other. says the scenes that we have been playing out on elite American campuses, scenes of the most explicit racism, are a national disgrace. Of course, in the United States, people have a right to public protest. And while I am pro-Israel in the current conflict, it does not seem irrational to me that others might wish to support Palestinian and criticize aspects of Israeli war strategy. But the protests are not merely supportive of Palestinians. They are supportive of Hamas. And they are targeted not at Israeli in particular, but at the Jewish population in general. Such protests are racist, at least according to the traditional definition before folks like Ibrahim Kendi and the BLM activists of this world managed to twist the term to suit their own interests. And that's where we're basically the title is, it's culturally acceptable now to be racist by calling people becoming anti-Semitic, but not charging on anybody else. And so he says, at the time, I suggested that evangelical pundits practiced talking about racism and Trump was a useful way of not talking about the threats coming from more culturally respectable forms of revolutionary radicalism. Bashing evangelical for being racist, and remember more expressions concerning critical race theory were not enough, it was a good way of not offending friends in the media establishment by having to address challenges raised by the LGBTQ lobby. Now it seems that gloating over evangelical disarray in the wake of Trump's recent statements on abortion and continuing to present evangelicalism as the most pressing threat to America fulfills a similar function with regard to not having to talk about anti-Semitism. So anyway, he goes on to say there's, not equal understanding of what, no matter who is condemning a particular brand of race or ethnicity, that's not to be acceptable. And so right now we have that which is culturally acceptable, and those are being found to not be as culturally acceptable. So again, Carl helps to bring this out in his clear words as he is able to do. And I think that he is spot on calling all of us to hold our positions, do so with clarity and understanding, and not just jump on some bandwagon coming along. And so whatever else may be happening, people are calling out people to be racist, and when in fact they have to take a look at themselves. So Paul, I think this really, like I said, ties in so much with what was said in the first article that Carl wrote.
Yeah, it's just a continuation. We had back-to-back Carl Truman articles on the list. So yeah, I mean, they definitely pair well together if you want to get Carl's view. I just kind of go back to what I said. It just all feels so familiar to 2020 to me. In 2020, on this particular issue of race, everything you did was racist, right? And I actually am hearing a ton of people talk about, anti-Semitism, and that term is broadly being applied to a lot of people now based on a definition, a very broad definition. So I kind of feel it's similar again, instead of a lot of people had to get over the biggest fear in 2020 was somebody would think you're a racist, right? I've said this many times before. That's one of the biggest fears for a lot of people. Like, I don't want anyone to think I'm racist, even if the definition is showing up to work on time is considered racist to some people, right? We dealt with all this in 2020, and now here it is in 2024. And now, just my opinion, I think there's a lot of people that are, they're now saying, everything can be anti-Semitic now, right? If the definition is as broad as the International Holocaust Alliance wants it to be, which is the definition that was in that bill that passed in Congress a couple of weeks ago to try to combat the rise of anti-Semitism.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Well, then we move in article number 4 of the top 10 to the church itself. And this is dealing with Methodism. And this is Albert Mohler speaking in, again, also in World as an opinion piece. Well, that didn't take long. He says the United Methodists quickly abandoned biblical Christianity. Well, how did that come about? He says the United Methodist Church committed theological treason yesterday. This was about a week ago, leaving biblical Christianity behind in headlong rush to join the LGBTQ revolution. In the view of the progressives, they were making up for lost time. In the long view of Christian history, they were marching off the map of Orthodox Christianity. So by a vote of 692-51, and without a word of formal debate, the United Methodist General Conference voted to overturn the church's historic discipline and doctrine on homosexuality. Yesterday's vote took place in Charlotte, North Carolina, but the impact will be felt worldwide. So he basically talks about the, a little history of the Methodist movement, goes back to John Wesley, who was the founder of it in the sense that his discipleship program was basically methodological. And from that, those who were following that were called Methodists because they followed a certain method of growing in Christ after you profess Christ. So then this church was divided in the Civil War. It would reunite in 1938. They eventually had a number of mergers in the 20th century. And then it says the church did appear united for decades, but liberal conservative tensions were fully apparent by the end of the 20th century, and it was the LGBTQ movement that eventually blew up the church. Though United Methodists were the last of the old liberal denominations of mainline Protestantism to officially join the Rainbow Revolution, liberal Methodists had long rebelled against official church teachings and policy. They elected gay bishops and fueled LGBTQ activism, ordained LGBTQ ministers, and officiated at same-sex weddings, all in open violation of official church doctrine and polity. And I think just reading that paragraph just is amazing that they did all these things and the church itself as a whole didn't discipline or take note. And so as a result of that, there was quite an exodus that took place in the United Methodist Church, and not only in the United States, but global Methodism itself. And with these issues looming, the conservatives once thought that they had the upper hand. They believed that they could force a division of the church and the liberals would leave and establish another denomination that was more friendly to the LGBTQ community. But the conservatives overplayed their hands. This is a couple of years ago when they had met as a conference, and the conservatives were actually outnumbered and eventually outmaneuvered. And once they understood the situation, it was the conservatives who wound up leaving, so that in 22-23, no less than 7,000 congregations left the United Methodist Church. And in some conferences, such as the one centered in Dallas, close to 70% of the churches left that denomination. So now, when they had this meeting in Charlotte just a couple of weeks ago, the more liberal progressive side of the church no longer worrying about conservatives holding them back, without debate, as we read, changed their book of order and completely went the other way. And that's hence the title. That didn't take long at all. So this is what happened when the General Conference of the United Methodist Church fully abandoned biblical Christianity and did so before the watching world. And the United Methodist Church is neither united nor a church. So I think Southern Baptists like Dr. Moeller, writing about the United Methodist Church, and if you're in the South, it was Southern Baptist, United Methodist, and then Presbyterians that were sort of the triumvirate in most towns and cities that you traveled. So we sort of all cooperate together, work together in different ways. And now things have been splintered and this church is gone. So you have now two churches. One, the church that still has the name United Methodist, and then another one that will have another name, probably something like the Global Conference of Methodism. So Paul, there goes to show that the conservatives at least had a solidifying power for a while, kept the church from going off the rails, but they left, then the church went off the rails.
I mean, you know, it's just incredible as somebody who, you know, watches the General Assembly of the PCA every year and you know, got to go to a day of it last year. You know, to see how the process works in our system of government. And so I watched a lot of the United Methodist Conference. And, you know, when the people were getting up to the microphones and everything else, they kept giving their pronouns and their transgender, and they kept having to call themselves an adult. I mean, it went something like, "Hi, my name's Bill. I'm from, you know, so-and-so church, and I'm an adult cis male gender." You know, I mean, it just, and it was like, I couldn't believe it. You just couldn't believe, now that these 7,000 churches have left, there's just no one else to push back. There was one minister there, I believe, that spoke against, you know, the affirming of same-sex marriage and gay clergy, from Africa, Liberia, I think. And he told them that what they were doing was wrong and it was against the Bible. And, you know, they just dismissed him and everything. They didn't care what he had to say, but they're without excuse. And it's sad. It really is sad. But at the same time, you know, there were some people that, like you were alluding to this, Dominic, you know, left. Some people might say, why didn't they stay and fight? If you go watch, there's like a 3-minute montage. I think it's Woke Preacher Clips that has it over on Twitter or X. And you just say, well, there was no way to negotiate with those people. There was no way to negotiate with people that had already put the pronouns and every little, you know, they just created a new law for themselves, you know, and they're going to make sure every jot and tittle was followed. And so you don't blame the ones that left, because they had to stand up for scripture, and they could not be. The United Methodists have not been united for a very long time. Now they're united over sodomy.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. Okay, number 5 takes us into a historical thing where we have an article, Stonewall Jackson Saved by Providence. This is an article by David T. Crum, who is a history professor in a college, at university, I think. And he got interested during his doctoral studies in Stonewall Jackson, Thomas Jackson, who actually his final name. Stonewall was the nickname given to him by his soldiers. He says, my story on researching Stonewall started in 2013 when I proposed a graduate level research paper on Civil War, proposing a paper titled God's Friend or Foe, the Confederate Army. Being a Yankee, I aimed to prove how wrong the Confederates were. My professor kindly informed me I would be shocked by the Christianity found in the Confederacy and urged me to proceed carefully, though he said I should still proceed. And so I thought about it and revised my paper to The Confederate Army and God. My professor was right, and I came out shocked, most for what I thought. And us doing this paper, he just developed this relationship in his mind to Stonewall. And so he's written a book. He says there are several books on Jackson and his beliefs, and I thought I would sought to accomplish something different with my book, which is Stonewall Jackson Saved by Providence. So that book has just come out by David T. Crum. I aimed to defend his beliefs and prove that he was no fanatic, yet a biblical born-again Christian. Yes, even in Jackson's day, biblical Christians had a reputation as fanatics, but not much different than from today. So in this article, he just gives a precursor to this book to say he's still a Yankee, but he loves Stonewall. And I think that's an interesting statement to make. He, at the end, take position, and he quotes from Dr. Douglas Somerset the following about Jackson. Satan tries to push human cultures from one extreme to another. In one generation, slavery is callously tolerated. In another generation, the condemnation of slavery becomes excessive, as if it were no other sin in the world. Many of those most vehement in their opposition to historic slavery support the destruction of unborn children in the womb. While denouncing the sins of the past, they defile in their hands with equally heinous sins of the present. He says, Dr. Crum ends up, I ask my fellow Christians to consider reading Stonewall Jackson's The Christian Life and see what kinds of lessons it can offer for us to, as we look back as historians into the lives and practices of the church and other believers and other generations. I've appreciated getting to know Dr. Crum some through correspondence with him, and appreciate the book that he has produced here as well, Stonewall Jackson, Saved by Providence. And we can rejoice in that. So here's a take where what we're 160 some years from the event that divided our country. And it takes time for things to settle down enough to we can begin to look at it, some sense of, you know, rationality without losing the passion. Paul, when I teach church history, I have 10 reasons for studying church history. And one of them is that there are many dark periods in the life of the church, but even during those dark periods, there were glimmers of light. And we can see that as we study the history of the church.
Absolutely. Stonewall Jackson is just a fascinating guy to study. And I quoted him last week, you know, the quote about, you know, you're just as safe on the battlefield, or you should feel just as safe on the battlefield as you do at home in your bed at night sleeping. You know, I mean, his reliance on the sovereignty of God is something we can all learn from.
Yeah. Okay, then number six, another book. This is a review by Jane Voss, and it's a review of A Christian Guide to Mental Illness. And this is a book written not too long ago by David Murray and Tom Carroll Jr. It says, the subtext here, the church should never underestimate the power of including those suffering with mental illness and welcoming them into the church family. And so in this review, Jane Voss says, in this book, sits on my list, she says, of top five books about the topic of mental illness, written in 2023 and 244 pages long. This book is divided into 30 short chapters, which can easily be read in minutes and small chunks of time. It says, what makes this book especially unique and helpful is the very candid personal stories on the topic. At the risk of being pegged a gadfly, I will not repeat any of the personal stories. Suffice to say that these stories add a definite tone of humility and utter dependence on the Lord, not to mention personal touch, which draws the reader in and makes the book a page turner. So in this book, she breaks it up into the various parts that exist here. In the chapters, first 11 chapters are almost 100 pages, focuses on mental illness, what it is, how it affects the sufferer, the spiritual life of those around the sufferer. Moreover, addressed are how people react to it, having it, hurdles to overcome, and the causes. The next chapters, 12 through 18, focus on roles, such as the roles of pastors play, having sufferers, a role of the church community, role of the family and friends. Furthermore, the part of professional, what they play, meditations and biblical counselors are touched, medications and biblical touch counselors are touched on. So a very helpful, brief review by Jane Voss, but a very helpful to say, here's a book that maybe if you haven't really looked into it and you want to say, what can we do in the church? I want to be a little more aware. This is be a good primer to begin with. And knowing the issues that we face in our culture, there's probably not a church that doesn't have a need, or any of us who are listening here or reading this book that aren't aware of some friend who wrestles in some way with his or her issues in his or her life. So, Paul, this, I think, very helpful primer to start with if you're looking for a good book to start with.
Certainly. Yeah, certainly it's intriguing. And again, I know you said this, the purpose of this book is to help the reader understand how the broken brain does not work, an analogy to a broken arm, to set the broken brain in the context of the gospel and to discover how the church can bring comfort to the mentally ill and their families. Yeah, it's something certainly intriguing. And especially in light of a world where it just seems like we have a new drug every day for something like this, right? And so you also have to navigate that.
Absolutely. Okay, well, the seventh article is titled Paedo Baptism, Yes. Paedo Communion, No. So the word paedo, of course, is most of you aware, the word for child or infant. And of course, then it would be infant baptism. this article saying, yes, it, we affirm that those who hold to a paedo baptism or that children are to be brought into the membership in the church and acknowledged as members by virtue of their baptism. And paedo communion is the thought that maybe the some think the logical extension is if children can be baptized, then indeed they should be able to take communion. And this article then argues, no, that there's that's not a consistent way or right way to look at it. And so it's broken up into different parts as look at this this article here. The covenant status and the requirements for partaking of each sacrament. For instance, first, due to their covenant status, personal acts of faith such as credible profession are not necessary for infants to be baptized and yet are necessary for them to partake of the Lord's Supper. So a credible profession as validated by the elders of the church is required of those outside the visible church in order for them to join the covenant community. Converts to Christianity must enter the covenant community first by professing faith in Christ, and then they can be admitted to the sacrament of baptism. However, infants of believers are already members of the covenant community and are federally holy. As members of the visible church, covenant infants have a right to the initiatory sacrament of baptism, and this is why profession of faith is not required of covenant infants before receiving the baptism. Unlike the requirements for adult baptism, the requirements for worthily partaking of the Lord's Supper are not given to unbelievers, but rather to the covenant community. There is no similar twofold requirement for their sacrament like there is with baptism for regard with regard to unbelieving adults versus covenant children. So this sacrament is exclusively for covenant members, not for outsiders of the covenant, which is why the prerequisites for worthy partaking of the same are for all are the same for all of those who are already covenant members. So baptism ought to be administered to all who are in the covenant of grace because it is the first sealing of the covenant, and now they've entered into it. But supper is to be administered only to those who are visibly capable of nourishment and growth in the church. And therefore, it is to be given not to infants, but only to adults, as a quote in this article. So the question of that, and then the manner of participation, as well as the infant baptism, infant benefits of infant baptism, but not from the, or from baptism, not from the supper in an outward as well as in an inward fashion. So I think it's a very helpful article for people who wrestle with this, and it is a major topic of the discussion among believers in the covenant community. So I think this article is very helpful that for us to read, and this one you'd probably want to have discussion on in your small group or your Sunday school class, and maybe even within your own family.
Absolutely. It's a really helpful article at a time when, you know, a lot of people are having questions about this. So this is really, really good and timely.
Good. All right. The eighth article is Provident Christian College Board calls Dr. Stephen B. Kortenhoven as president. Provident Christian College is in Pasadena, California. It was started just at the turn of the century. Started out in the Inland Empire, as they call it, in Chino, Ontario area, east of Los Angeles, and then eventually moved from there to Pasadena, where it now has holds its classes. Just as a point of information, two bits of history, Paul. I had privilege of serving on the board of Providence Christian College for a number of years, and then for 2 years I had the privilege of serving here as interim president while I was still serving also as president of New Geneva Seminary in Colorado Springs. So I went between Colorado Springs and Los Angeles quite a bit during those 2 years, and found Providence Christian to be a just tremendous school. It was still getting its feet wet and growing and developing, and it's really matured in a wonderful way. So that's one point. The second is Stephen Kortenhoven, was a child when I was pastoring and beginning a church in the Los Angeles basin just east of Long Beach, and he and his family were regular members and tenders of that church. So I've known Stephen for many, many, many years, and I think the board made a very wise decision of choosing a man who not only was raised in a covenant home and church, but also really understands Christian education and will bring great value to Providence Christian. So he was just called to be the fourth president of Providence Christian College in Pasadena, and wish him well. And the story here will give some background to him. And so I commend this article. I'm glad it was chosen in the top 10. You know, usually something like this is sort of more of a, public PR piece, but people took interest, and I'm glad it made it here. And I wish Providence and Stephen very well.
It was Providence that chose <That's right. laughs> to be on the list.
Yeah. By the way, just in case, just a little throw in there is their mascot, being that has a Dutch influence here, are called the Sea Beggars. And that has a specific historic reference to the revolutionaries or those who were seeking to have Holland separated when they were part of Belgium and Holland were together as the Low Countries, and they were under Spain and they wanted to be free of Spanish rule. And so eventually that came about through the Seebeggers, who sort of were guerrilla warfare guys in that period of time in the 1600s. And finally Spain released them, and they came about with a contract or after a little bit of a war, where a treaty then divided the Low Country between Catholic Belgium and Protestant Netherlands. And so the that came about during that time. So the Sea Beggars carries on that tradition here. Just a little tidbit. Nobody asked. Thought I'd just share it.
Well, no, I've got to follow up. I mean, I'm just ignorant.
Sea beggars. Yeah, they would attack the of course, Spain was, you know, big, had big, large ships, and they controlled the sea a lot until England probably helped put them down a peg or two in the war in 1588. So the defeat of the Spanish Armada. So they would attack these ships because they could get in a rowboat and get them along ship and maybe put some plastic or whatever was before plastic on ships and sort of irritate them and blow holes in their bows of their ship. And they would quickly get away. And so they were in the sea, and they were dressed like beggars. So they,
okay. Okay. Yeah, dressed like, I got yeah. you. Now yeah. I'm with you.
Okay. Sort of like the men at Lexington, if you think about that, with the mm-hmm. first shots heard around the world. All right, number nine, Will the End of Protestantism Be the End of America? By Aaron Wren. So here he's reviewing a book and speaking of it from a man named Emmanuel Todd, His Grim Prognosis of the Defeat of the West. So the title, Will the End of the Protestant Be the End of the Protestantism? He says, French historian and demographer Emmanuel Todd was the first person to have predicted the fall of the Soviet Union. He noted that unusually, its infant mortality rate was rising, and that they had even ceased publishing of the statistics on it. Based on this and other data, he concluded that the Soviet Union had entered into the final fall. In something of a parallel in that book, his new book, The Defeat of the West, published in January this year, says that the West is on track to lose the conflict in Ukraine. Unsurprisingly, this was received poorly by critics who accused him of repeating Kremlin propaganda. What caught my attention, this is Aaron Wren speaking, was that Todd blames the fall of Protestantism for unleashing a crisis in the heart of the West itself, and that this, rather than Russia's invasion of Ukraine, was the true source of our problems. He writes, the real problem facing the world today is not Russian, Russian will to power, which is very limited. It's decadence at the American center, which is unlimited. That's a scary thing, proposition, Paul. It's the decadence of the American center. You can see why people hated this. I read the book for myself to see what had he had to say about Protestantism. And so he goes on to say, here are some of the research he's done. Remember, Todd is a demographer and so forth. And he says, for example, he argues that in the defining the decline within the Soviet Union and so forth, that the Russian family structure created a social state that was amenable to communism. Russian families were strongly patriarchal, and all of the sons lived with their father. This created an ideal simultaneously authoritarian of the father and equality between the brothers. Communism was, in a sense, an embodiment of this type of social order. And that's something to think about, whether that's really true and can carry over, I don't know, but at least he put those things together. There's a copious amount of discussion about the family structure in this book, but Todd adds that an overlay of religion, he sees Protestantism rather than the market, industry, or technology as the heart of the modern West. Its most critical impact was a drive for universal literacy so that all the people could read the Bible in their own language. It also created the famed Protestant work ethic. An educated, industrious populace led to the takeoff of economic growth in Protestant countries. Indeed, Protestant countries were the most advanced industrial economies in Europe and basically remained the leaders. Todd believes that France benefited from being adjacent to a band of Protestant nations because it killed off a lot of the Protestant population that they had. So he says, if Protestantism brought positives to Europe, it also introduced the idea of inequality in a profound way through its idea of the elect and the damned. Hence, Protestant countries also created the worst forms of racism, as in the United States, and anti-Semitism, as in Germany. He cites the fact that Protestant areas of Germany were more supportive of Nazis than the Catholic areas. The root of the nation state is also in Protestantism, but not in the French Revolution or anything of that nature. He writes, with Protestantism, there appeared peoples who, by too much Bible reading in their vernacular, believed themselves chosen by God. In this analysis, he seems to be basically recapitulating a lot of Max Weber, whom Todd describes himself as a student. So that lays the foundation of why he says is the demise of the West, the demise of Protestant is rather a reason why the West will also go through a demise. So this is a long article. We can't teach it out, but I hope the tease that comes here might be enough to sort of stir you to read this long article. Just one other part here, Paul. He says, Todd believes many of the negative contemporary trends in America are product of the Protestant decline. Now, this, remember I said earlier in our review here of the 10 articles that we bring up about the Romanization of culture, that we're reverting back to Roman culture. And so when I've read this, I thought this is where it fits, because more what he says from this point in the article seems to fit into that narrative that others have also been suggesting. He believes that the arrival of the Protestant zero state, there were three levels of Protestant state, the Protestant zero state has produced a culture of nihilism in America. He notes, for example, America's falling life expectancy and growth in so-called depths of despair. He also makes much of America's infant mortality rate, one of his favorite statistics, an area where he thinks that we're doing poorly. So the decline in the life expectancy and the rise in infant mortality are two other factors he puts into the equation. So it's not just the problem of plaguing the citizenry, though, but the way America's leadership has responded. He writes, but the most astonishing thing is that the rise in mortality has gone hand in hand with the highest healthcare costs in the world. Though not from the book, there's a graphic here that he refers to that shows how with all the industrialized Western countries and other places, how they where the United States fits in with other parts of Western culture and where Protestantism and other religions are. So it's an interesting thing. Of course, it's sociological based on statistics, and we know statistics can be twisted every which way. So here is one aspect of it. The part that I was thinking about as I read through here is there were other times when I think you can read in the history of the church, especially Western civilization since the Reformation, where things got desperate and it looked like there was a demise of culture. And I would say that one of the things that happened is that there was the movements and revivals and reformations that took place in various parts of the world, not necessarily every part. The Reformation had a major effect broadly, but then over the years, there would be times where there would be the rise of the Great Awakening period of the 1730s, 40s, 50s, for instance, being one of those. So I just found it fascinating that at least looking at it from one historical side, it is something, at least a wake-up call for the church. So from that point of view, I think it'd be an interesting read. And so I really commend this as being laying a foundation or seed form of how we in the church need to begin thinking about how we interact with our culture so that what he's saying here may not happen the way he prognosticates. So good article by Aaron Rend that stirs the mind here really well.
Yep. I agree with you. I don't really have any more to add. This is, I think, the longest article on the top 10 list, and it's worth it, though. It's worth it.
Okay, and then last one that brings us back into our reality here about the Presbyterian Church in America once again. In this case, an overture that has been presented and will be considered by the PCA General Assembly when it meets in June this year in Richmond, Virginia. Overture 26 seeks to keep accused church members in the process for their own good and reclamation. And that is, the proposed amendment solution is to expand potential representatives. That is, someone who will be like a lawyer that will know something of the Book of Church Order and how to handle cases. So we'll expand personal representatives to a communing member in good standing of a PCA church or any member in good standing of a church court. Another possible benefit is ensuring the accused church member will have competent representation is a reduction in the number of appealed cases. Sessions might be have more incentive to be careful and reasonable in following the process for dealing with discipline cases when the accused persons are properly assisted and represented. The intent here is right now, the way the Book of Church Order is written, that if someone is brought against somebody by the session at the local level, then someone in the church can be a representative for that individual, most likely would not necessarily be that conversant in the Book of Church Order or maybe prior judicial cases. And so the person may be found guilty, so he appeals. And so it goes to the presbytery next. And then at the presbytery level, it can be someone who represent who is a member of the presbytery. So that'll be teaching elders and ruling elders from the member churches and so forth. So he's saying, well, if we had ability not to develop a class of elders, you know, or ecclesial lawyers per se, but just people who are at least aware that can come alongside and help both sides to do things well, because so many mistakes can be made if you're not careful in judicial process. So the intent here is broaden the ability of proper and good representation. That's the intent of what this overture is presenting. So, and Paul and I, you were talking off air before we came on and said part of this does develop out of what we talked about with the things that happened in Jonesboro a couple of years ago.
Well, yeah, I mean, he says, Brad Isbell writes about this, why is representation before the courts important? Here are a few reasons, most from the whereas section of the overture. He references the spiritual good of offenders themselves. He says representation may simply mean having someone to sit with an accused person at trial to help them with trial preparation. Help may mean hope, and it may allow an accused to stay in the restorative process rather than flee, thus separating themselves. Talks about our robust biblical process of church discipline are necessarily unique, sometimes complicated, and foreign to the normal life experience of church members in particular. In other words, our process is good and biblical, but complicated. Representation can help the accused with complexity. And then this last one, for building up and not for destruction. Discipline is to be exercised as under a dispensation of mercy and not of wrath. He goes on to say, a court that does not stack the deck against an accused or callously allow them to be baffled and disadvantaged by process is being kind and merciful. These proposed rules would make it easier for the accused to obtain or be assisted by the court to obtain competent, unbiased representation. So, for those that are familiar with, you know, what happened, which was written extensively by Ryan Beasy, and also, you know, he wrote, you know, those articles appeared on the top 10 list. I mean, essentially what that could mean was, is, you know, Dominic, you represented me, you know, myself and six other men before the SJC, but you were not allowed to do so at Presbytery, and you were certainly not allowed to do so at the session level. This would change that. This would have allowed you to have been there and maybe avoided, you know, what was a very long process. Maybe. Mm-hmm. Maybe.
Yep, exactly. And so we'll see how that goes. But it's, I think, a very helpful overture. And it'll be, notice it's number 26. So that means they're 25 ahead of it. And there are a few I know that come afterwards. So it should be make for an interesting General Assembly. Well, it's the come to the end of the top 10 articles in the Pulitzer Report for this week. And we're so glad that you've been a part of this broadcast with Dominic Aquila and Paul Harrell. We appreciate you listening. Trust that tomorrow, the 14th of May, when you get your newsletter, that you will quickly read through, just see what you want to set aside to sort of do a deep dive in. Other things you can just read carefully and cursory. And we appreciate very much being listeners as well as readers, and trust that the full report continue to serve. And until the next time, we trust the Lord will continue to rise up and give you blessings.